Previously on Video Killers.
It's just the freestyle, meanwhile we keep the beat kicking. Sweat dripping, girlies in the limo eating chicken. Oops, don't get the grease on your pantyhose. I love you, Robo, move over, I gotta blow my nose. Sneezing, but still I'm pleasing all of Slimmies. Pull out my Jimmy, time to get busy with a Jenny. If it's good and plenty, don't you know? There I go, there I go, there I go. But I don't go the way.
Hello and welcome to the Video Killers Podcast. I am Tim Hawley, your host, and I am joined by my other great co-hosts, one half of Tape Freaks, Colette Ritchie. How are you?
Hi, I'm good.
And Greg Kay, our wonderful engineer, editor, and also contributing person to the Tape Freaks blog.
A crazy man.
Crazy madman, Greg Kay.
Just hanging and banging, my friends.
Oh, boy. Is there any good or any fun news that's come out in the last week that you know of, Greg? I guess you've been paying attention to the Friday the 13th box set, right? They just revealed some notes from that. Did you look into it?
They did. But you know what? I didn't.
All I saw was that they had found lost cut kill scenes from part two that have been sort of notorious for years on a VHS tape that's going to be included. But sounds like they added a ton of stuff. I saw people freaking out, but it literally would take me like half an hour to read through all of it. So I didn't.
It's a lot.
It's so much.
I didn't have like the listing previously announced to compare. The list took me like 10 minutes to read through. Right. So that's, you know, and there's a lot of new content. So it's exciting. It should be a fun one. And then also Severin is releasing Cruel Jaws, and I ordered the Cruelest set, which comes with a toilet lid decal and squirt gun, and then it comes with a novelization as well, which, I don't know, seems fun. And then it also comes with two movies. It comes with Savages, which is I'm not familiar with, but it also comes with Massacre in Dinosaur Valley with Michael Sopke, which I own the old Shriek Show DVD. It's a great movie, so I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, I've never seen that one, but I've been aware of it for a long time. The Savages one, that one is directed by the Indonesian director who did the original Satan's Slaves. So I'm like kind of curious about it, because it's like,
sure,
it's another Indonesian film that I was completely unaware of. I can't believe that Severin has figured out a way to release Cruel Jaws, or at least is attempting to. Like, that's a movie that I never, ever thought would make it to Blu-ray, because it uses footage from Jaws 1 and 2 and The Last Shark, which has also been, like, pulled from releases because of its just blatant ripping off of Jaws. So the fact that they put together this Frankenstein of a movie on Blu-ray is insane. And also, like, the novelization, that the fact that even exists, that's awesome that they're putting that out.
It's exciting.
Yeah.
Like you said, we'll see.
Right. Yeah.
I did order it, though. I did pre-order it. So
yeah,
fingers crossed it's going to come one day. I also, a little fun news for me is I ordered Waxwork just put out fairly recently John Carpenter's The Fog and Escape from New York on vinyl.
Yeah.
Were those out before?
Yeah. Deathwaltz did reissues of them in the
Deathwaltz.
Yeah. Okay, they did. Yeah. Like, I mean, this was, I think I picked up those. Escape from New York was the very first or second Deathwaltz release when they were still in the UK before they were involved with Mondo. So that one came out like, I don't know, 2014 maybe. And then The Fog was like one of the later releases before they merged with Mondo. So that's also been out of print for a while. But they both got reissues from Silva Screen, I believe, at one point since then. But those, I mean, whenever they get reprinted, they go out pretty quick. And those scores are both like so good.
Yeah. Two ones I'm missing, and I'm pretty excited. And the artwork is amazing. Yeah. And of course, I really love the colored vinyls they do.
Yeah,
you know, like the statue. I got Statue of Liberty green.
Okay.
For Escape from New York, and I got the Green Fog or whatever it is on The Fog, which is exciting.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. They both look incredible. If I didn't already own them both, I would definitely have picked those up. I saw that they're also releasing the Rob Zombie Halloweens, which, you know, big surprise. They put out all of Rob Zombie stuff because of Jagger or whatever, the guitar player from White Zombie masters all of their records for that label. So he's like, they're like deeply connected to Rob Zombie. But I know some people are really excited that those, because I don't think those have, either of those have been released in any form that I'm aware of.
No, I mean, that's, it's exciting for people that that get into that. I can't remember even much about those movies except for that redneck swearing nonstop. That's all I remember.
Yeah.
Sorry, yeah. Rob Zombie. I wanna, but.
And then the other thing I noticed is that Scorpion is really, they've kind of gotten into some of the canon film stuff recently, and they are releasing the original Delta Force on Blu-ray and a new Paul Naschy film, The Fury of the Werewolf or Wolfman on Blu-ray. They just announced a couple days ago.
That's exciting. Yeah. I have never delved into the Paul Naschy movies at all. So that's exciting.
Yeah, we've seen a couple, but it's definitely a blind spot because there's so many of them. It's, yeah.
Who's Paul Naschy again?
He's a really, really popular Spanish horror actor who is like kind of like the is like almost like Christopher Lee and Hammer, like but in Spain, like he's the Wolfman. He's like, you know, whatever. He plays a bunch of a lot of Wolfman movies mainly, but he did a lot of like all kinds of horror films. He was just like a very big horror icon in that. Like, again, I don't know enough about it, so I got to dig a little deeper.
My wife and I just watched Delta Force a couple months ago because we're slowly working our way through all the canon films. So
that's awesome.
And it held up. I mean, it's 80s canon cheese.
Totally. It's ridiculous.
What I always thought was pretty fun is Robert Forster's the bad guy, but he's playing Iranian terrorist, so they just gave him a tan.
Oh gosh. I didn't remember that. That's crazy.
Yeah. I don't think it would hold up nowadays.
And I guess the last bit of news is a big one, is that Fangoria is officially back up again and has changed ownership, thankfully. So that's an exciting, and they're bringing back the editorial staff. So Phil Nobile Jr. and Meredith Borders and all of them are coming back to continue the magazine. Like, it didn't even stop. So
nice.
That was a big surprise. Yeah. Like, I wasn't expecting that to happen, actually.
I saw them talking about that, but it was on Twitter and I couldn't follow it back far enough to figure out what they were talking about. And I was like, Tim will just tell me later.
Yeah. I got notified because I was a subscriber that my subscription was going to auto renew in 2 days. And I was like, oh, hell no. Like, what's going on? And then I had to go look into it. And then I was like, oh, cool. They sold it. And
now, so who owns it now?
Press release says it's the Beast Beast and Tragedy Girls, Tanya Ansley, the CEO of Wonderwall Entertainment, and entrepreneur Abby Gull have purchased Fangoria. I don't know them. I got to look into it a little bit more, but people seemed very excited about it. So it seems like positive news that Fangoria is once again alive.
Yes. Yeah.
I guess we can get into what we've watched this week. You want to start off, Greg?
My wife and I went on an excellent adventure.
The most excellent movie in town is Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure.
Oh, it was the most excellent movie. You should take your babe to see it. It was, like, totally righteous.
It makes history fun. It's the kind of movie that girls will like because they're adorable.
Very bodacious.
I'm in love with Bill and Ted.
Everything you'd ever want in a movie is right here.
Demand excellence. See Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, the smash comedy hit from Orion Pictures. Rated PG, parental guidance suggested.
We watched all three of the Bill and Ted movies this weekend.
Nice.
I like how it's not cliches. I like that the story has an alternate universe and it carries through. It's kind of funny to me as well that the first one is in the 80s, shot in 87, released in 88 or 89. And the second one is released and made in 91. Like, one feels 80s and one feels more 90s, you know, and like it's not even that many years chance, but it really does feel like I'm honestly surprised Bill and Ted didn't go on a grunge, you know, like run or something too. I think it was right before grunge broke. So they didn't do that, but so they had Faith No More.
I think that there's talk about it, wasn't there? Because there's been like talk about a third Bill and Ted movie for years. Like, it was like in the works for a little bit and then it kind of crumbled and it was in the works again. It was in the crumbled. Then like way later, then they like started this up, and this has been like 10 years or more coming now at this point. This new vision, I think.
I guess the script's been around for at least a decade.
Yeah.
You know, in variations, and they've been tweaking it. But finally, it really came down to Keanu Reeves, I think. You know, once he said, all right, I'll do it, they're like, could do it.
Right.
One of the best parts is Rufus, George Carlin, is classic in that as well. It's kind of funny because it's just a movie you've just watched. You just enjoy it. There's nothing. If you think too hard, you're going to be poking holes in it left or right because, mm-hmm. you know, none of it really makes sense. And then the second one is actually the best one, in my opinion.
They're back.
How's it going, dudes?
They've changed. They're on a mission. Bill and Ted are out to destroy Bill and Ted.
Catch you later, Bill and Ted!
Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey. Rated PG. Parental guidance suggested.
They had a little more of a budget to work with. The actors who played his father, Ted's father rather, has a scene where he has to... Ted jumps into his body, so he basically is Ted for a moment.
Okay.
The guy's acting is great. Oh, right. It was hilarious. Yeah, he did a great Keanu Reeves.
Okay. Dudes. I mean, fellow policemen. My son, Ted Theodore Logan, and his friend, Bill S. Preston Esquire, have been murdered and replaced by evil robots from the future. You totally did it, dude. I totally possessed my dad.
So that really made it. And then like the main villain, which they didn't really have a bad guy in the first one.
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking about it. But the second one, they had Goss Ackland.
Hmm.
And he's best known in some circles as the Lethal Weapon 2 villain.
Oh, right. You know? The diplomatic immunity.
Exactly right. Yeah. I kept waiting for him to say it again when watching it. I think I riffed that line about 15 times watching it, too. I did some research on this, and apparently in the original script, Bill and Ted were supposed to use a van to go back in time.
Okay.
But Back to the Future was such a hit, I think they ultimately decided we'll go with a phone booth instead.
Right.
So apparently Doctor Who wasn't
that
big enough show back then. Bogus Journey also has William Sadler as Death, which... He's awesome in it. I love the part where he's telling them they have to play a game with him, like the classic play the duel with the devil, and no one ever wins. And they start playing games with Clue and Battleship and Twister, and of course they win. And I thought the script was pretty clever in the second one. It was fun. Hmm. On to the third one, Face the Music. It was a blast. It was really fun. I mean, it's in the same spirit as the first two. It's mainly about their daughters, and the actress who plays Ted's daughter is pretty funny. She's basically doing a young Keanu Reeves. And they do address the issue. You probably don't remember, but at the end of Bogus Journey, they bring their toddlers up on stage, and their names are Bill names his Ted, and Ted names his Bill. You know, the boys, but they address that.
Okay.
I won't tell you how, but it's funny.
Yeah, we're about to rewatch all three probably this week. We got to watch them. I'm excited to check out the new one, but I got to revisit those first two because it's been so long since I've seen them.
The message of all the movies is really is be excellent to each other, be good to each other.
Yeah.
And honestly, right now in this year, 2020, it's refreshing to hear.
Yeah.
So it may not actually fit the vibe of 2020, but
what does?
It was a really nice break. So that's what we did. We went on an excellent adventure and we came back happy because of it.
That's awesome. Most of the stuff we watched this week has been research for our main subject matter, but we did watch a movie, despite Greg warning us not to, for good reason, which was Blood Shack, the 1971 sort of slasher, sort of nonsensical.
I mean, it was a slasher.
There is a legend about this valley, a tale carried across the winds of time, a legend strange and sinister. The legend of the Trooper.
Stay away, you hear me? Stay away! The Trooper will get you!
But it didn't make any sense. Yeah. It's a Scooby-Doo episode.
Yeah. But it's Ray Dennis Steckler, who's the director, who did Incredibly Strange Creatures Who Became Mixed-Up Zombies. Did I get that right?
Yeah, I think that's like half the title.
Yeah,
it's super long living title. And became mixed up zombies.
Yeah,
yeah,
but yeah, it's a weird one. We watched it on YouTube. It was like the whole thing, which is 55 minutes, is available on YouTube, and it's literally not. There's no way anybody could watch it on their own. Like it would be just grueling.
Yeah,
I can attest to that.
Yeah, which is I think why you're like, don't even bother. I was like, oh, I've just always been curious about this. So we had watched a bunch of people on Zoom, and we had a blast because it was just like. It's sort of a Manos Hands of Fate, kind of nonsense, meandery. There's like whole scenes where his kids are just clearly ad-libbing in front of the camera, having
adorable,
but talking about nothing for like 10 minutes.
Yeah, they're just telling kid stories to each other. It's
Oh man, it's a weird one. It's just a shirtless dude who just keeps warning people to not go in the shack, and then they keep.
And then they immediately go in the shack
and then die.
They're like, "What? But I have to." And then he's like, "Oh, you're gonna die." And then they die. And then he has to bury them in the desert.
Yeah.
Like, begrudgingly.
Yeah, it was a fun watch, but in all the most, yeah, it's.
Don't try to watch it alone.
But it's, I feel like it's an interesting movie because it's like it's out in the kind of desert. It's like got a very dirty look to it, and I feel like it had to have, because it's 1971. It had to play a factor in influencing, you know, Tobe Hooper with Texas Chainsaw Massacre, mm-hmm. who did, you know, that,
for
like
sure.
3 years later, and like even like Evil Dead 1, mm-hmm. like the shack kind of has that Evil Dead vibe to it. I mean, I'm not saying it's anywhere even remotely close to those movies, but I feel like it's a fascinating sort of artifact of like this kind of helped maybe lead to that potentially. I mean, it's maybe not. Yeah. Maybe they didn't. I've never saw it. But
maybe they all just saw the same things that were influencing them all together. Yeah, but like, it really seems like
it's just early in that like zeitgeist. They,
like those later people saw that and was like, I can do that. I can do at least that.
Right. Yeah. Just with less rodeo footage.
Yeah. There's so much rodeo footage.
I know, for a 55-minute movie, too.
Yeah, it's a lot.
I just remember there being a lot. For anyone who's interested, there is a plot, and the plot, kind of, is a young woman inherits a ranch that is supposedly haunted by a murderous beast called the Chooper.
The Chooper. They keep the bad guys.
It's Chopper in the credits.
But they always call it the Chooper.
Chooper.
Yeah. And there's like a lake underneath the desert that somebody wants, and yeah, it's...
Yeah, it's...
It's pretty nonsensical, but yeah, it was a fun watch. And
yeah.
Well, it would be interesting one day. We should probably do that, is explore a little bit of Ray Dennis Steckler's output in the movie world, because he's an interesting character. He worked with his wives always. He put family in his movies. He's he's just a homegrown,
totally
crazy director. He's most famously, I think, known for Rat Fink.
Yeah, Rat Fink and Boo Boo.
In Boo Boo, yeah.
Or Rat Fink a Boo Boo, I think that's what it's called.
Yeah, there you go. Rat Fink a Boo Boo.
Weird crime fighting kids movie. Yeah, he's definitely one of those regional filmmakers that I'm fascinated by now, and I'd want to do a more deep dive into, because a few of his movies were put out by Something Weird and before he got into like just hardcore porn. But he did do a number of wild kind of horror films, it looks like, in the 60s, 70s. So yeah, Bloodshack is piqued my interest.
I'm sure that his hardcore porn is also wild.
I'm sure it is. And Something Weird may have put some of that out too.
Yeah.
In all the wrong ways. Yeah. Trust me. I think I've seen half, you know, clips of one.
Oh.
For research.
Hardcore research.
For Joe Bob Briggs fans, their Shriek Show did put out a DVD back in the early 2000s of, he does a running commentary on the whole movie, Blood Shack, and also the incredible mixed up zombies as well. But I remember the Blood Shack being fairly fascinating to listen to.
I bet.
Is he doing, it's like a historical kind of thing? Like he's like,
right. He's not doing his Joe. I mean, he's doing it as Joe Bob Briggs, but he's not doing that stick where he introduces it. It's a historian type of commentary.
And movies like Blood Shack leave you asking a lot of questions
with very
little answers. So knowing some of that stuff is like kind of half of the adventure of going into those movies.
Right.
And if people do pick up that Shriek Show DVD, be warned, that cover is one of the most misleading covers I have ever seen.
Yeah.
It's terrible. Oh boy. That's mainly what we watched this week. We kind of, most of the rest of it's for our subject. So anything else you got, Greg?
Yeah, I dipped into Vinegar Syndrome's Pandemonium.
Oh, nice.
Never before has one motion picture dared to bring to the screen.
Which way to the cheerleader camp?
Pandemonium!
Which was a really fun movie. I enjoyed it quite. It was a comedy in the vein of wacky kind of airplane Zucker brother type of humor that wasn't as good, but it doesn't mean it's not fun. It, you know, it's got a crazy cast. It's got Carol Kane, who plays a character that's more or less a spoof on Carrie White.
Okay.
And then Paul Rubens shows up in early role as kind of an Igor, but not, it's kind of a sidekick. Tommy Smothers is the main character. The plot, if you want to know what IMDb says, and I guess it's right, because it's just not really a, not much of a plot.
Your eye but rolls are not coming through the podcast strong enough.
I can't roll my eyes enough on this. Tommy Smothers stars as a brave Mountie who, along with his trusty horse, which, by the way, he has a puppet horse the entire movie. Sometimes it's not a puppet, though, and sometimes it is. It is trusty horse and bitter deputy Paul Rubens must track down a killer who is stalking co-eds at a nearby cheerleader camp. I guess the plot is basically this killer is taking out cheerleaders and they stop the whole cheerleading program at this college, which is you had to be there, Nebraska, I think it's called something really silly like that. They stop the program and they restart it up. And so everyone's worried that the killer is going to strike again. And spoiler alert, it does. Judge Reinhold is in it. Same year he broke out with Fast Times at Ridgemont High.
Right.
He does another masturbation joke, which is kind of funny.
That was a shtick, huh?
I guess.
It's getting typecast.
You had Tab Hunter shows up in the movie. Phil Hartman pops up. The director did Alice, Sweet Alice.
Okay.
And so I don't know why they hired him for this, which is a comedy. I think maybe because they're like, it's horror-ish. But he took it seriously because he has an interview on the Wernicke Syndrome disc. And it's a pretty interesting interview.
Yeah, I was going to say, how are the features? Does it kind of give you some answers?
That's really it.
Okay.
They have that, but in trailers. But he went to the Groundlings, which is a famous improv group in Los Angeles. And that's why you see a lot of this cast. Paul Rubens was a Groundling, Phil Hartman, and I'm sure many of the other ones, that a lot of them would just pop up in roles, probably were Groundlings that didn't make it as big as the other ones.
Right.
Mark McClure is in it, and you know him from Superman. He was Olsen, what's his name?
Oh, Jimmy Olsen.
Jimmy Olsen,
yep.
Thank you. And then also he was the brother in Back to the Future.
Yep, I was going
to
say, yeah, that's...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The disc is great. It looks great. But I did find on YouTube, there's a Commander USA version, which was a show on USA Network a long time ago. It's kind of fun because there's old commercials on it and stuff.
Oh, cool.
But support Wernicke Syndrome and buy it. If you like them silly, if you like them stupid, you can't go wrong. I laughed a lot, but it's, you laugh and you almost feel guilty for laughing. It's one of those kind of movies.
Yeah. It's like in the same vein as like Student Bodies and some of those ones, right?
Yeah. A little more innocent outside of like I said, a masturbation joke, but that's about as crude as it gets.
Okay.
Wow. And there's some clever kills, but they're not gory. And the kills are fun. I guess I think it's actually better than Student Bodies, but Student Bodies has the best poster.
Right. So it's a good one.
It's a great poster. That's all I have to say on that one. Did we watch Nightmare Beach this week?
Oh, we did. Yeah. We did watch Nightmare Beach together.
Oh, that was this week.
Yeah.
Wow. That's...
Yeah.
Yeah.
I realized something when I was thinking about it. Because I had trouble staying awake in that movie. It was just slow.
Yeah.
But we had watched Blood Beach a while back. I just realized John Saxon, both, of course, it's the same plot, except for it's a monster in Blood Beach and it's a motorcycle guy killing people in Nightmare Beach. But in other words, he's the cop.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
I think he's a bad guy in Nightmare Beach. But
he's a bad cop.
Yeah.
He's a bad cop.
But he's not the villain.
He's corrupt.
He is corrupt.
He's not the main villain. Yeah. He is part of the villain gang, though.
I mean, he's not connected to the killer exactly, but he's basically helping him.
He's not the killer, but he's part of the villain gang that's in it.
I mean,
there's so many villains.
I mean, the movie's just basically villains, yeah. But yeah, the plot of Nightmare Beach is, it's spring break. It's an Italian production filmed in Florida during spring break, I think, or at least like to make it seem like a spring break.
It had to have been.
I can't imagine. There's no way they could have created that much crowd. But it's a bunch of people that are down there for spring break, and then people are getting picked off by a lone motorcycle person Is that
a motorcycle electrocutioner?
Yeah, I guess. This is somebody who's electrocuting people with a motorcycle.
It's a lot of people, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Well, he's like, really, it kills everybody with electrocution except for...
A couple. There's a couple he does
like
other things.
One guy, he's like kind of cuts his throat, but I think everybody else pretty much gets electrocuted in some way or another. Anyway.
It was silly.
It's pretty...
It was very silly. There was a lot of really great outfits in it.
Yeah.
And a lot of like... I feel like you were like nobody was really likable in it. For a while it was like who is the bad guy in this, because there were so many of them to choose from.
I think my favorite character was the lead woman who's sort of one of the heroes. Yeah, the bartender who's like everybody in her family has been killed one way or another. And it's like she's like
my parent, you know, my grandma died of a heart attack over there.
My parents
died in this house here, and like what?
My sister was murdered.
Like,
oh boy,
goodness!
But then it also stars Michael Parks as the coroner, who's also an alcoholic coroner,
drinking out of a flask the whole time.
Who's great to see in everything he pops up in. People will know him from Robert Rodriguez and Quentin Tarantino films as usually some sort of sheriff. But yeah, it's fun to see him in a role like that. Where he's a little dorkier, a little, you know, just like awkward, mm-hmm. drunk.
Oh yeah, and then his character has a tragic, dark death.
Yeah.
Oh boy, some weird things happened in that movie.
I feel like there's a takeaway from that movie that we will be referring to for a long time, which is every time the main characters wanted to party, they would just scream out, brain damage! It's like, what?
That's right. The one guy was obsessed with that. Yeah. The one character kept bringing it.
It's like, what?
Jeez. You know, it's so funny that we just watched that movie and it feels like, you know, weeks ago or months ago.
I was like, that was this week.
It didn't feel like this week. And I just was like, where the heck did the month go? But like, apparently this week dragged on, I guess.
I did like that the biker gang was called Demons, and it was obviously the logo from the Demons movie on their backs.
Yeah.
It was kind of cool.
Yeah, that's such an awesome little nod.
Since it's a slasher, I try to remember to do body counts, and there's 10 in Nightmare Beach, also known as Welcome to Spring Break.
All right, we should get to our actual topic. Rudy Ray Moore movies.
This is Rudy Ray Moore, better known as Dolomite. I'm the one that killed Monday, whooped Tuesday, and put Wednesday in the hospital. Called up Thursday to tell Friday not to bury Sarah Dillon's son. I've got an all-girl army that knows what to do. They're fox as hell and practice kung fu. Dolomite.
I guess before we get into Rudy Ray Moore, though, I'd like to hear from you guys about when you were first made aware of Rudy Ray Moore and what your first exposure to him was.
Back in 2002, I think they released the first box set, and that's when I first on DVD, and that's when I first became curious on who this guy is, because I knew I grew up watching. I went blaxploitation backwards. I watched I'm Gonna Get You, Sucker.
Never has a film moved so many and touched so deeply. United Artists is proud to present I Am Going to Get You, Sucker, a captivating story.
Yo, baby, hold it. That ain't it. It's I'm Gonna Get You, Sucker.
Let's get that sucker.
It's the good guys against the bad guys.
Oh, how come their guns are so much bigger than ours?
It's a phallic thing. I don't know.
Good girls against the bad guys.
You must got the devil in you.
And it's bad guys against the bad guys.
Now you boys can leave either through the window or the stairs.
I'm gonna get you, sucker. Even if you can't say it, you got to see it.
I got you, sucker.
So anyway, I started going in. I found that he was a dude who was doing like kung fu and stuff. So I always thought they were kind of kung fu movies. They're really not. It's just Rudy Ray Moore kind of fancies himself a kung fu guy.
Yeah, I mean, that's what they were selling him as.
So yeah, I just kind of kept hearing more and more about him, and I actually heard his albums or clips from his albums before I ever saw the movie. But now that last box set that came out from Vinegar Syndrome,
well, it's not a box set, but they released the four major the main films on Blu-ray, but they kind of spread them out over that year when they eventually released them all.
Yeah,
but they put all the interviews,
the documentaries,
they're all like
broken
up into the different discs. I'm like,
which makes
made it a box set.
But it makes sense because each documentary does focus on that time period in that
it's
film.
True, but it could easily be one whole.
Oh, I think it was. I think maybe it was in that DVD box, or it might have been made, or maybe it was made, I don't know if it was made for the Vinegar Syndrome discs, but I think it maybe was originally like one whole piece. Anyway.
Yeah, I don't know without looking, but I have since rectified that, and I have seen the wonderment that is Dolomite and Human Tornado. Or wait, how does he say it?
The Human Tornado!
Tornado!
For me, I was like, I remember in like junior high, I was kind of becoming more aware of blaxploitation films in like the 90s. And I remember first being aware of Rudy Ray Moore. I think it was partially the Comedy Records samples, but then like hip hop mixtapes and that. But I think there was like a skate video that I had that had a song by the Voodoo Glow Skulls, and they used a clip from Dolomite on that, where it was like, the man move over
and let me pay. Oh, they have to be pulling these hush puppies out your motherfucking ass.
Like that clip, like kind of led in the song. And so like, I was like, kind of like, what is this? And then like, it took me a while to try and track it down. And I remember finding a copy, which I thought it was Dolomite at the time, but it must have been Human Tornado, because I vividly remember that like shot of him running naked down the hill and then rewinding it and then like playing it at, like,
yes,
instant replay. And I'm like, what am I watching? This is crazy.
I think he says something like, you motherfuckers don't believe it. Here it goes, you know, and he plays it again.
Yeah.
You don't believe I did it the first time?
Yeah.
Here it is again.
Yeah. And I remember like looking for the movies, but couldn't find them at that point. Like I kind of was like, had like film books, and I was like kind of like trying to do some research and like trying to find out like more about stuff like that. Like at that time period, you know, there's no internet, and trying to like, you know, collecting these cult film books whenever I could get them from the library or whatever, and going through like meticulously and finding more about him, but couldn't find the movies for a long time. And I think they were re-released like on VHS in the 90s. And a friend of mine found whatever the movie, it was Human Tornado at this time, but he found a used copy at a rental store that was like in their like previously viewed bin, but it was still like $20 to buy it. So like I was like, I'll throw in $5. Like I've been wanting to see one of these movies forever. But yeah, he's a crazy, interesting, like filmmaker, actor, comedian. Like, I mean, he's like, mm-hmm, such an interesting career. And I feel like if people haven't heard of Rudy Ray Moore, or they haven't really dipped into it, I think that Netflix movie My Name is Dolomite is a really good starting point, even though it does kind of blur the lines, but every good biopic kind of does. Like they kind of get the core of the good natured of him and the kind of people that he surrounded himself in the film, and I think it does a really good job of showing that, even though it's a little bit fast and loose with a few things, and it does glaze over some key people, specifically Lady Reed. I feel like that she doesn't get enough like kind of a umph in that movie, but I realize it's like it's about him, but it's still, sure, you know, like I think that she's such a major player in that kind of world. But the screenwriters who did that Netflix film, they are the biopic like writers. Like they did, you know, Ed Wood, and they did The People versus Larry Flint, and they did the OJ show and stuff. I mean, like they're really, really good at what they do, and I think they did a great job with that film. So I think that's a good starting point for people. And if you like that movie and you haven't dipped into Rudy Ray Moore movies, I think that there's a whole world of weirdness that people, nobody's prepared for. How insane they are.
And Eddie Murphy is really good. He kind of plays it as Eddie Murphy playing it, in my opinion. So that's fine at first, because I literally just watched Dolomite. He doesn't have the same cadence as much. He doesn't say motherfucker as awesome as Rudy Ray Moore does. That being said, ultimately, I love that movie, and it immediately made me just want to watch more of Dolomite movie, more of Rudy Ray Moore. I love that Lady Reed is, she's probably the best actor he has.
Oh, for sure.
His network.
Was it in Human Tornado when she's in she's just like the lady who also has a kid in the hospital?
No, that's in Disco Godfather.
Oh, Disco Godfather. Yep. She's amazing. Like, there's no reason for her character. And she's like, oh yeah, well, I'm just going to take this as far as I can go with it.
Yeah.
She's crying. I mean, she's like the dramatic and crying, and like it's great.
Yeah, it's so good.
She's really great.
Now, girls, you shouldn't be shocked at the word, because I mean, sometimes when you use it, you get the best old feeling sometimes using it. Like when your man come into you and he did something damn disgusting, you say, motherfucker. You know, and if you weren't quite afraid of being knocked down, you could say it like this. Why, you motherfucker. You get what I'm trying to sound? All right. Now, you know within yourself, when he's doing to you right, and you want to try to tell him like what he's doing, and you can't find the words to say it, and you say it like this. Motherfucker! They like that.
When I went to, I was like researching Rudy Ray Moore rather, and like finding just tons of stuff, like so much information about him and all the different people that he influenced and all the different people who talk about him and, you know, like openly are like, yes, like this is where I got my style or my whatever. But then I was like, all right, now Lady Reed. And I literally couldn't find anything except for a little bit of her comedy records on YouTube. And that was it. She did not have a IMDb. She did, or maybe she did, but it did just listed the movies that we were aware of.
Yeah, as far as I know, she's only been in Rudy Ray movie, Rudy yeah. Ray Moore movies.
She is,
Then that was it. She didn't have a Wikipedia page. There was no interview about her that I could find. There was no article written up about her. There was just literally nothing of her on the internet. And I was so upset because they're on the Vinegar Syndrome. It's on one of them.
It's on the Dolomite disc. Yeah.
There's an excellent interview with her when she's a grandmother. And she talks about, like, you know, like her end of what was going on. So, like, the craziness that she endured because she was a woman on the road, or, like, you know, what, how it, you know, how that all happened through her eyes. But that's it. Like, there's no, like, she's not in the behind the scenes documentary that kind of goes through the whole.
They cut to a couple clips from that interview, but that's the only known interview before she passed away, I think, is it's like a VHS like camcorder set up in her like living room, and they're just like interviewing her, and it's like 20 minutes long, maybe something like that. But it's so fascinating her hearing her side of it, because so much of what you're hearing in a lot of these behind the scenes and like these kind of like vintage clips of Rudy Ray Moore and the people talking about it is like all their perspective of it. And so much of what Rudy Ray Moore is like, depending on the clip, he's spinning it one way or another, because he's totally a huckster. I mean, like, it's like, so like the facts coming from him are very fast and loose, just depending on his audience at that time. But that interview with her is really, really interesting.
Mm-hmm. Well, my career first started off, I was like a groupie and a writer for Rudy. And then he gave me my first break and told me, oh, you can do it. And I'll never, never forget. It'll always be in my memory bank. The first time I hit that light, Rudy had to stand there and hold my hand because I was just trembling all over. And he stood there with me until I could sort of get my legs. And that was nice. So we struck out for the roads, and he told me what I needed and what I had to do, you know, and how it would be. And he always made the guys respect me. So consequently, being Lady Reed, I had to stand up to that name, okay?
On the first Dolomite, I think we should start there, I guess.
Yeah, for sure.
For people that don't know, if you haven't seen the Eddie Murphy movie, if you don't know Dolomite, he got the act from a local homeless man that used to do the...
A wino named Rico, he says.
Yep, Rico. And... Yeah, and that's, I mean, he was a stand-up comedian before that didn't have much success, and he was also a musician who didn't have much success, and then he kind of hit on something.
Yeah, I mean, his basic backstory is that he grew up in Arkansas, moved out of there as fast as possible, as soon as he could, and then kind of went to, like, Wisconsin and a few places to try stand-up comedy and never quite hit it, and then he got to the L.A. in the 50s, and he worked at a record store where in the record store they had a DJ booth. And so he started getting on the air when they needed somebody just to jump on for like a little bit to like the song of the day or whatever. Guy kind of got cut his chops a little bit on the air doing that. And then the guy who owned the record shop, who also owned a record label, got killed, like was like killed by one of the artists who claimed that he owed him money or something like that. And it kind of threw everything off. But during that time, Rudy Ray Moore made a lot of connections in the LA scene, knew a lot of labels and a lot of people in the music industry because of that. So he went and recorded this. The Rico, the homeless wino, whatever, that he said that would come into the shop, he'd like give him money for soup or whatever to get let him make him do some like a Dolomite act, things like that. And then like basically took that and like kind of formed it into his comedy routine, went and recorded a record, but then nobody wanted to distribute it. So then he toured around the country selling these records out of the, literally out of the trunk of his car.
Yeah.
And ended up having this huge hit record that was entirely self-distributed up until that point. He eventually got distribution, but like at first it was like he sold a lot of copies like on his own, completely grassroots, because nobody wanted to touch it.
I mean, and that alone is that American dream that everyone likes to claim that America right, had. Yeah. You know, I mean, that really is someone who, you know, made it happen for himself. And, you know, when you have everything against you, not helping.
And yeah. He did it twice, because that was also how he sold Dolomite.
Yeah, he took the money from the records that he had, like, was like a bunch of the titles of the records are This Pussy Belongs to Me, where he's like pointing out some cats, but he's got naked women around him on the cover. And there's a Eat Out More Often, where it's like him like looking at a naked woman on a couch. Mm-hmm. And so that like very X-rated like party records. Right. And then took the proceeds from that to fund a film with these people that he had kind of surrounded himself. Like he kind of built a crew of people that he trusted and then used them, kind of pushed them into the roles that they were like best suited. So like, I mean, the people that he was around, like Jerry Jones, who was like a screenwriter who wrote The Human Tornado and Dolomite, he kind of helped out through a lot of it. And then there's T. Tony, which is like his producer through the four major films that he worked on. There's Jimmy Lynch, who is like a guy who did like a lot of the set design and costumes. They're all featured heavily in the documentary, and they're also featured in that Dolomite film by different actors. But those are like kind of some of the key people in his repertoire that he worked with a lot. Like, and then there's the one cinematographer, Nick von Sternberg, is actually the son of Joseph von Sternberg, the famous director who did a lot of the Marlene Dietrich films, like the silent film.
Oh, wow.
So his son was the cinematographer on Dolomite, one of the cinematographers on Human Tornado, and was also a cinematographer on P.D. Wheatstraw. And he's also heavily featured in that documentary, and it's got some insane stories. But yeah, he took... So back to the creation of Dolomite, the film, was literally like he took the money from like basically risked everything, all of his records from the record label to get an advance, and then toured around the country to save up enough money so that he could fund this film. The initial budget they had was around 70,000 was what they're shooting for. And according to Rudy Ray Moore, they did it for 90,000. The cinematographer claims it was 140,000. So it's kind of up in the air about how much exactly they spent on that first film. But there was a lot of production problems leading into it, because a lot of them just didn't know what they were doing. And then the director, Duvel Martin, he was an actor who was in a bunch of Fred Williamson movies at the time. Kind of was a bit of a name. His biggest claim to fame was he was in Rosemary's Baby. But they wanted him in the movie because of his name notoriety. But then part of the deal was that he was going to direct it, but he wasn't a director, had no interest in directing it. And admittedly, by everyone around that worked on that film, is that he was constantly like, this movie's never going to get released. I don't really care. Like, it was really just didn't really put in the effort. And it only kind of got through the finish line because of all the people that were working on it that were so passionate about trying to finish the film, which is insane that it even got released.
I envy his drive to keep going. No. You know, it's inspiring, to say the least.
Well, and also just like propping everyone up around him, like everybody that around him that had some he would see talent in, he would push them, you know, like do everything he could to help them, to elevate them and give them a foot in the door, and to try and like, I mean, like there's a lot, some great interviews with Ernie Hudson about Human Tornado, where he's literally saying like, there's so many black actors and black crew members and that were in LA looking for work and just couldn't get work. And Rudy was really just creating jobs for people. And that like, mm-hmm. he'll Ernie Hudson's just basically, you know, like I respect him to this day. And like, I'll forever be grateful for the opportunities that he gave me, and that the people that he knew that they had opportunities through Rudy Ray Moore, which is, it's awesome to hear. Like, it's just like, it's totally like that DIY filmmaking in the most insane way possible.
Yeah. Why did you want to make this film? What do you think people, what did you want to tell people about this guy?
Well, like I said, he's inspirational. He's first and foremost, he's very, very funny. And his movie started off like, if you watch a Rudy Ray Moore movie, his movie started off kind of like, they were like, kind of stoner pictures. They were kind of movies people would smoke, and then they would like look and say, hey, look what he just said. Or he'd throw a punch and he missed by a lot in the punch. Or the microphone, and you could see the microphone come in the shot. So it was stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And that's what made everybody start watching him initially. Then, you know, I started doing comedy myself, and I started seeing him a whole different way. And then when I got into movies, it was like, then I found out how he made his movies. He became an inspirational figure to me. Like I said, he's a guerrilla filmmaker.
And he never says a bad word about anybody. No. Even about Duvall Martin, he's like, you know, if he had known, he's saying in the documentary, he's like, well, if he had known the movie was going to do well, he would have put in more effort.
Right.
But he really just didn't. Like, he's, you know, yeah. He could easily just be like, well, that jerk, whatever.
Yeah.
But,
but once he got the ball rolling, it looked like he just went crazy. I mean, let's see, Human Tornado was 76, Dolomite was 75,
mm-hmm.
Petey Wheatstone was 77. I'm assuming Disco Godfather was 78.
79. Disco Godfather took a little longer to get off the ground because of some of the production problems. So, but still, yeah, 75 to 79, that's an insane output for someone.
And then none of them knew how to make a movie.
No, it was
they hired like films. The cinematographer was still a film student.
Yeah, right. Most of the people were.
And they were like, oh, hey, you guys know what you're doing? Come on over here and make a movie with us.
Well, and then like he says, like, so there's the story is that he was living in the Dunmore Hotel in
Dunbar.
LA. Dunbar. Dunbar? No,
Dunbar.
Is it? Okay.
Dunbar Hotel.
Okay. Anyway, yeah, Dunbar, I guess. He's living in the Dunbar Hotel, which was the like Ritz-Carlton for black performers in the day or back in the day at that time. And it was really run down at that point. But like, you know, back previous, like when like all these like jazz musicians and things like that would come through into LA, they weren't allowed to stay in the fancy hotels. So the Dunbar was the place that they would stay. It was like, that was just what it was. But when in the 70s, it seems like it was kind of run down and shut down and there was no electricity. So Rudy Ray Moore was living there, but like, I don't know if he was squatting exactly. Like, it's never really said that he was squatting, but it seems like he must have been because
it seems like it.
There was no electricity in the building. And it was like, I mean, so they were saying that there's pools of water everywhere and like he was living in the basement.
Holes in the walls and holes in the flooring.
But then also, like, some of the scenes in the movies are in there and they are fantastic. Like, is it in Dolomite, the second Dolomite movie, where it's like, the room is like the walls are like upholstered and there's mirrors everywhere.
Yeah, that's
like,
in Human Tornado. The one
when he in part one too, really. They have a lot of mirrors on the walls. That was kind of a joke in the My Name is Dolomite.
Yeah, right. But yeah, and then partially that has to do with like the set designer guy was like literally I was like, you know, I can work with, you know, I got some drywall, I got some paint, you know, I was like, I'll work with what I got. It's like literally just like scrapping it together with whatever they possibly could get.
Putting mirrors over holes and stuff.
Even in the first film all of the films were shot in the Dunbar. All four of them had scenes shot in the Dunbar. And they were constantly having to rewire the panel because they could find electricity in the panel. And the camera crew knew how to like work on electricity, I guess. And so they were literally stealing electricity to run the lights and to run everything.
Well, they were film students. They knew how to steal electricity.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. They didn't know anything about wiring, but they knew how to get it for free. So is it just Dolomite and Dolomite 2, or is Human and Tornado the second Dolomite?
Human and Tornado is the second Dolomite.
Oh, God, that's so good. Proper nouns are hard.
But yeah, when he finished Dolomite, just real quick, I guess, before we move on to Human Tornado, he finished the film and showed it and nobody wanted it. Like nobody wanted anything to do with it. So he toured it around again, like he did with the records. He brought it to this theater in Chicago and supposedly there was a line around the block and he sold out like a bunch of back-to-back-to-back shows to the point where they said they brought in $17,000 just that opening day or opening weekend, breaking the previous record that that theater had held in the 60s with a James Bond film. Mm-hmm. So this completely DIY film was just like, just a smash hit from right out the gate. And they got like reviews. He said there was a review in the Chicago Times, whatever, that said that The film was so bad and so vulgar that it wasn't even fit to be seen by a blind dog. And so they took that and then they printed it on a bunch of the flyers.
Yeah.
And so then they just like, it went like wildfire at that point.
Yeah. Embrace it. I love it.
Yeah.
That's so good.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. You see how bad it is. You want to see how bad it is? You got to come see how bad it is.
The other funny thing is that they wanted to film it in widescreen, I guess in a different film formats. There's like a ton of them, but the main ones are, you have 4:3, which is the box, you have widescreen, and then you have CinemaScope. They were trying to film it in widescreen, but they were filming, when they originally started, they were filming it 4:3, which is the box. And so they didn't actually see dailies until 17 days into the shoot. So they shot a ton of footage, not realizing they were shooting in the wrong aspect ratio. Mm-hmm. And so they had to crop that out to get, because there's just tons of boom mics. You can see the camera crew in shots. Like it's amazing. The Vinegar Syndrome disc includes the boom mic version, which includes that footage. And it's crazy. Like, it's so cool to see that, because you can see beyond the frame, you know?
Yeah. It's like a behind the scenes thing while it's happening. Like,
it's so awesome. Yeah.
I saw clips from that as well.
It's so funny. But yeah, like, so then that was distributed. He eventually got Dolomite distributed through Dimension Pictures. And I believe that so was Human Tornado, which then a little bit, like, I guess before we get it through Human Tornado also had a smash hit. It was even bigger than Dolomite, but then Dimension Pictures went bankrupt and he lost the rights to both films and all the money that he was supposed to be receiving from the both films. So going into Petey Wheatstraw, he had to completely like start from the ground up again, which was and it took him 12 years to retain the rights, to get the rights back to both of those movies, which is horrifying. He had to rely on his comedy records still because he was just so screwed over by them. He figured out, so many different ways to just make it work. Like, and just surrounded himself with people that had that same mentality, that same drive and that same passion, and just a DIY like mentality where they literally just figured it out like as they went. Like, it's, and the what they got on screen eventually is bananas. Like, I still can't believe some of the stuff that they were able to pull off, and some of the stunts and random nonsense that are in these movies it's pure exploitation bliss. I feel like if you're interested,
it's gold. It's 100% gold. Anyone out there who hasn't seen these movies or doesn't think they know what they are, but doesn't, you don't.
You have no idea. And that was when I was like, I thought I had an idea going in, and I wasn't like, oh, I don't want to watch these movies. I was like, oh, cool, I'm going to watch these movies. And I was like, what the hell? How come nobody told me that these are just like absolutely amazing, but also insane?
Yeah.
My note for Human Tornado was just fucking wow.
So was that your first time watching that last night, or had you seen it previously?
No, I had seen Dolomite previously,
okay,
but I had not seen Human Tornado.
The first of all, Dolomite is a lot like, I think it still might be my favorite, because I like that it's more rough around the edges. I like that it's more punk rock, and like, you know, it's just, even though it's like the less polished of the two, but I still like that one more, I think. But like the Human Tornado, like, they basically took notes off of their own thing and were like, here's what we're going to do next time to do better.
Right.
And they just improved everything.
Watch out, mister. Here comes the twister.
This is Rudy Ray Moore.
Yes, I'm the Human Tornado. I chain down thunder and handcuff lightning. I'm so damn strong, it's sometimes frightening. I grabbed a star traveling 1,000,000 miles a minute and slowed it down to the state speed limit. Yes, I'm the Human Tornado. Spinning, grinning, and sinning. I used an earthquake to mix my milkshake. I eat an avalanche when I want ice cream. I punched a hurricane and made it a breeze. I swallowed an iceberg and didn't freeze. The Human Tornado. Flinging cash and talking trash. Free me, delayed, relayed, mislaid, and parlayed. Jump, thump, bumped, and mugwump. The Human Tornado. Rated R. Under 17, not admitted without a parent or a note from your jailer.
It's the same plot as the first one.
It's totally, yeah.
Yeah, they were like, we don't need to waste time writing. We already have a really good script.
But with the creativity that was brought into Human Tornado is so bonkers. Like, they do so much insane stuff with the editing and with the with some of the set designs, and these, like, they're just completely up the ante.
Breaking the fourth wall almost immediately.
Yeah,
like, I was just like, what? Who? Like, It's so interesting to watch people make like art in a, like in a, not a medium, but like in a school of thought or whatever that they don't know anything about, because they will always do the things that you forget were possible and do them really well.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, that's part of the reason I love weird indie filmmakers and in regional filmmaking, is that those people do things that you, no person who knows how to make a film would ever do. And like, right. they take chances, or they do crazy things that, like, it's like, I never even thought that you could do that in a movie.
If you don't know the rules.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're free.
Yeah. And there's so much of that in these Rudy Ray Moore movies.
They rewind. That's the one where they rewind. Yeah.
What are you, escaping the evil Kenny Rogers?
Yeah. They rewind and replay a scene, and then he tells you he's doing it as the audience member. Right. Like, who does that?
It's crazy because he literally, like, naked, he's naked, jumps over that wall and rolls down that hill. Like,
yeah. And he was naked a lot. So if you're anyone out there interested in seeing Rudy Ray more naked,
here's
your chance.
Where you should start.
You could tell he was having, because he really liked being kind of a kung fu guy. And you could tell he really kind of worked on him a little bit more. It seemed this time. It seemed like he was a little bit more smoother than he was in Dolomite.
Yeah. I think, though, that had more to do with the director, honestly.
Oh, probably.
Because
probably.
He knew how to block and, like, sell it.
But they still edited it funny. I counted at least 4 times where Rudy Ray Moore did that weird growling thing. Yeah. That was like, but he would do that, and then he would do his, like, moves, and then all of a sudden he'd kind of look at the camera, like, getting approval. Like, a quick glance every time. Like, they just always kept that part in where he's just, you see him looking to see, was that as cool as I think? Yes, it was. Yes.
Well, and then the fight scenes in the second one, for sure, they're trying to do more, and the director knows how to shoot them. But then they're also saying in behind the scenes, like, they didn't choreograph any of it. So, like, they're just literally, like, just they're like kind of just going for it in the moment. Like, okay, I'm going to do this and this, I guess. Like, they weren't practicing it ahead of time. And even Ernie Hudson says he knocked a guy's tooth out by accident, like, by connecting something.
Ernie Hudson was built like a rock in that movie.
Yeah.
You know, I know him like everyone else does, Ghostbusters, you know, and other stuff since.
Ray, when someone asks you if you're a god, you say, yes!
A little quick aside, Ernie Hudson, he had been in like one film before this, and he was like Lead Belly, but this is really one of his first films. But at the time, he had gone to Wayne University in Detroit, and so he knew the director, Cliff Rockmore, who came on to direct Human Tornado, and that's how he had met him. So they had gone out from Detroit to L.A. to try and work in the film scene in L.A., and they met Rudy Ray Moore. It was mostly Rudy's crew, but Cliff brought in his own talent in some people, and Ernie Hudson was one of them. But at that time, Ernie Hudson was, I think, like living in Minneapolis, directing a play that was going to happen at the U of M that eventually moved to another theater in town, I guess. But he had said that it was like, it's for the U of M, and they were doing all these rehearsals. So he was going back and forth from L.A. to Minnesota.
Have to know how cheap it was to fly in the 70s. If he's just like flying back and forth to do a Rudy Ray Moore movie and then also direct this play he's doing.
Well, I don't think it was all that cheap. There was a lot of gas issues back then too.
Yeah. So, I mean, he kept saying he was flying back and forth. Who knows how many times he went back and forth. But he said it was over a course of a couple months that he was going back and forth, and that they were eventually going to shoot him out with all of his dialogue scenes so that he could, so he would be done. And then he could, because his play was about to open. And at one point he was like, okay, we're literally opening the play. I can't come back. So we need to be done. And so he left, and then they still needed him for scenes. So Ernie Hudson's brother went to LA and then refused to shave his head, because Ernie Hudson at that time was bald. So his brother wears a terrible bald cap. And with that stipulation, Ernie was like, okay, like, but make sure that he's blocked and make sure he's in the background, that he's not in the foreground.
Oh yeah, don't worry.
And they're like, yeah, we got it. And then he's straight up in the foreground. What, like,
Ernie Hudson's brother?
I didn't even know he was supposed to be him.
Yeah, so it's supposed to be him, yeah.
But Ernie Hudson's brother does not look like Ernie Hudson. Like, they do not look like each other at all.
Yeah.
He's like, the brother is like at least a foot shorter.
Definitely not as like,
not
ripped.
Not as fit. Yeah. He's like.
And Ernie Hudson's like tells the story in some of in the documentary, and it's great. But he even says like when the movie came out, Ernie Hudson had like representation. He had a manager at the time and went and saw the film in the theater. And then
with his manager.
And saw that like a bunch of the scenes where his brother is sitting in for him, and his manager fired him on the spot.
Yep.
He lost his manager because of Human Tornado. But he said that it all worked out. He got another manager pretty quickly, and it ended up being a better manager and got him got him better roles and stuff. So like,
immediately got him better roles.
Even though that man, previous manager was a pretty good manager, I guess he was pretty happy with him. But yeah, he's like, it worked out, you know, whatever. And he's like it's all underwater at the bridge. But he's like, man, he's like, I couldn't believe it when I saw it on screen. He's like, they told me that he'd be in the background. And yeah, he's like straight up in the foreground.
It's like they're like featuring him in certain, like.
The other funny thing is that he kept bringing his friend out, who is another actor who he knew from Detroit, and he kept bringing his friend with him when they would go back out to LA for the shoots, and like, kind of like, hey Cliff, like, hey, you know, Rudy, like, just put him in a scene, just give him something, like, he just wants to work. And I guess his friend came with him, like, for those 2 months he kept coming out, and they just like, we don't have a space for him. And eventually, like, he kind of kept egging it on to the point where, like, Rudy was like, okay, fine. And he put him in the nightclub scene in the very beginning of the film, when you see a bit of Rudy Ray Moore's stand-up. And he's in that scene, he's going around and he's just like heckling everybody.
Insulting the hell out of people. So it's not even borderline mean. It's evil.
It's so mean. Yeah. But the guy, the last guy he heckles is like, he's like basically saying that
you're the kind of guy who would fart in the bathtub and bite the bubbles.
Yeah. It's like, this is the guy who just wants to do anything he can to be in the show. Movie. And that's his friend.
Yeah.
That's funny.
He's like, embarrasses the hell out of him.
And he was probably like, yay, because we're not going to cut that.
Rudy Ray Moore's mind is insane. Because, okay, so correct me if I'm wrong, but he is like, he's a night act that's doing very well. So he owns that big house, which he donates to the house to charity. But he's being prostituted out to the sheriff's wife. You know, yep. He's like, all right, hold on. I'll be right back. All right, I'll give it to you. And he's just, I love how he's just, his way of being a super stud is that women pay him to have sex.
A couple of things when we just rewatched it, I noticed was that one, that like when they get to LA and they're looking for Queen Bee and they're looking for whatever tornado lady, I can't remember what her name is.
Hurricane Annie.
Is it Hurricane Annie? Okay. Yeah. But it's like that sequence goes on for what, 20 minutes? Where like they're literally just going from club to club to club to club, and nobody knows where they are, or they're getting just tidbits. But like, there's different
watching everybody perform.
Yeah, there's performances, and it's like it seems to me that's like Rudy was like working the club circuit at that time. That it must have been like he knew all these club owners. Like, oh yeah, well, you can shoot in here for a day, or you can shoot in here for. But it's like also to showcase these clubs on screen. And also probably showcase friends. Performers that he probably performed with. Like,
that's exactly what we concluded as well, watching
it's
it.
Like, so awesome.
I like that part actually as well.
It's interesting, like when you watch these exploitation films and you, like we were talking about the carnival films a week ago, where it's like, it's literally just like a document of these like old carnies at that time period. This feels like you get to see a slice of the LA club scene at that time. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like you get to see. And it's just like, it's such a cool thing to just sit back. He's like, the plot doesn't matter at that point. You're just like literally just sitting back. It's like, oh, cool. This is like literally what it would have been to like club hop almost at this time period in LA.
You're like, wow.
Yeah, the movie just kind of wanders in and out of the plot whenever it feels it.
Big time.
For sure. The guy with the sparkly jumpsuit with the one long sleeve and one just like gigantic shirt cuff.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I think he's wearing a bow tie with like a, you know, scoop neck in the front. But that guy's the
that's Jimmy Lynch. That's the
Jimmy Lynch. Yeah.
That's the set designer. So he designed that
he
outfit.
Like made his own outfits for his band. Like.
Yeah, which is because they all of his like his crew gets like a role in each movie pretty much. But yeah, that was his role in that one.
Yeah.
One of my other favorite things is like when the two kidnapped girls get whatever kidnapped by the mob and they put in that basement with a weird witch lady. And that weird witch lady.
Thank you for bringing that up. Who the that was so bonkers. I didn't even. What?
Well, it's like, it doesn't make any sense. But she comes out and she's cackling and she's got that crazy hair. And I love it. The one lady's first reaction goes, "What the fuck is this?"
Yeah. Right. Same.
It's like, we all said it.
That's exactly what I'm thinking.
Yep. Where are we going?
The fuck is this?
It was like in Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, where he had like that witch that the sheriff always referred to. I thought that's where they're going with this. Like she was like his dark black magic lady, that guy who owned the nightclub.
But she didn't do anything.
She didn't do anything. She just cackled around, looked like a character from...
Really looked from H.R. Puffin stuff or something. Like
right! That's exactly what I was thinking.
Puffin stuff is building a box kite large enough to carry Jimmy and my flute home. And do you know what I'm going to do?
Ooh, something brilliant, I'm sure.
Keep your feet buttoned up, you flipped out.
Other fun credit is that Dean Cundey, If people know that name, he is an incredible cinematographer who shot, I mean, went Back to the Future and Jurassic Park and The Thing. And I mean, fantastic cinematographer.
I need to research more movies. I don't know those ones.
But he shot part of Human Tornado. And when they're talking to the cinematographer guy, who the Von Sternberg guy, he is admitting that like when he would be on set, they would both be shooting at the same time. They'd both be shooting from different angles, but he would like purposely like push Dean Cundey off to the side so that his shot was really boring and his the Von Sternberg's was better.
Really dynamic.
Because he didn't want to be like shown up because I'm certain you could probably see talent in him or whatever.
Well, I mean, yeah.
But it's like, it's so funny. Like
a couple years later, he did Halloween. Although the bad guys were pretty bad this one.
Oh, yeah.
Like, evil Kenny Rogers. That was a sleazy character.
Totally. Yeah. And it's so funny because it's like, I mean, it's one of the movies. It's like, most of it's so goofy and so like just like slapsticky, but yeah. Like their characters are just like dropping the N-bomb like over and over and over again. Like, the racist cop from the first one, he was saying that like when they were interviewing him for the role, he had tried out for a couple different roles in the movie. That they were basically asking him like how he feels about particular language and specifically that word. And that he was like, yeah, I mean, I'm comfortable with it because I was dating a black woman and she used to like always refer to him as the N word and back and forth. So like, he was like in a like a mental state where playfully he could just drop it. No problem. Which sure. Just seems like, oh boy, like it's just still like it's
70s it's with a different era too. Different, you know,
yeah, just, for sure.
I just love how they are kind of cartoon characters as well. Just like anything else in that movie. Like the hillbilly mom and son at the beginning.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Total caricature.
I mean, it's intentional, I'm sure. But like all of the white people have the like cartoonish, like minstrelly roles mm-hmm. and are exaggerated and are just caricatures of human beings.
And then I guess the last other thing I was going to say is the Howard Johnson, whatever, the Kung Fu guy.
Oh.
He's like, he was like Chuck Norris's, like he worked, did a lot of stuff with Chuck Norris, like, over the years, but he was like an actual, like well-respected Kung Fu artist. And he shows up in that scene where it's like, it's just like later we go, like,
oh my goodness. And like Howard touches her Johnson. Cheeks.
Yeah. He's even, that's his name in the movie too.
Yeah.
Howard Johnson as himself.
Playing himself. Yeah. That's so funny.
Well, you can tell when he's fighting because he's the only one
who for sure knows what he's doing. Yeah,
him and the guys that he brought, because there's a couple of times where I'm like, oh, that was his friend.
Yeah. But they said that he was kind of a little bit offended by how they were portraying Kung Fu at first, but then realized that like because Rudy Ray Moore is just like, a you know, he's a comedian first, that this was like totally like his way of like kind of filtering Kung Fu through his comedy. And he's like, okay, like, he kind of embraced it by the end and was like, mm-hmm. kind of like was proud of what they did on the film. Which is pretty cool. Fun. But yeah, he's a pretty well-respected Kung Fu artist. I guess we should move on to Petey Wheatstraw then.
Yes? I'm Petey Wheatstraw. The devil's son-in-law. The high sheriff. I went with Notorious Fanny and even made love to old Lulabelle. I took today and brought back yesterday. Took the 4th of July and put it in June and made leap year jump over the moon. I'm not here to brag nor here to boast. I can sit on a tombstone and produce baby ghosts.
The idea came from one of Rudy Ray Moore's records, but the story of Petey Wheatstraw, I guess, is like an old folklore tale. And it was like taken on by like a blues musician in like the 30s who kind of told some of these like Petey Wheatstraw songs as a blues under like some blues songs that Rudy Ray Moore was aware of. So he kind of took that and filtered it through like a Rudy Ray Moore filter into complete insanity.
Even for Rudy Ray Moore, this movie is bonkers.
It's mm-hmm. It opens with like a birthing scene.
That's amazing.
That features the director's son.
Yeah. Yeah. The son that gets birthed. Like, so a kid gets birthed out full grown but
like,
and swearing.
8-year-old.
Yeah. Swearing at people and stuff.
But he immediately goes and beats the dad up for bugging him every night.
Yeah.
Help me. Take him off me. Come on. Please.
I know you. You're the one that disturbed me every night in my sleep.
Let your daddy boy.
You stop it.
But it's Cliff Rockmore again directing this one, and he also wrote it, or co-wrote it, I guess. But I think he basically straight up wrote it based off of Rudy Ray Moore's kind of notes. But yeah, that's like one of his sons who's birthed in that. But he's not. It's not the first thing that births out of a watermelon, mm-hmm. and then it's the full grown kid who's just swearing at everybody. And I think isn't the dad in that sequence, isn't that the evil Kenny Rogers again?
Mm-hmm. He's the doctor.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. But yeah, it's the first Rudy Ray Moore movie that kind of delves into horror a bit, because you have there's a whole band of Satan and like these minions like in a kind of climactic scene on a rooftop by the end of it. But it gets more brutal and more a little bit more like it has a little bit more commentary in it. Like there's like that insane like moment where like the kid gets shot in the front yard with his brother, and that's Cliff Rockmore's other son who gets shot in the front yard and killed. And then there's a funeral scene for this kid who gets shot with his drive-by basically. But then at the funeral, there's another shootout and a bunch of people just get mowed down.
Everyone gets mowed down.
It's like, just getting murdered left and right.
God, it's crazy. Like,
and there's no, I mean, like in the film, there's no justification for it. It's all just like innocent bystanders being like massacred.
Isn't it reverse? And he comes back and everyone comes back to life and it does that reverse thing.
Yeah.
So I got about halfway through it. Here's some of my notes.
Go for it.
He still can't fight our act, but that's it doesn't take away anything.
No.
Wow. They shot up a funeral. Cause when all those people die, that's at the funeral for the kid that got shot in the lawn.
It's
so I'm like, what? Insane. Oh my God. Movie. Calm down.
Yeah.
I thought Hell was really cool. And it was kind of shot like an Argento film. it's all red gel lighting. And
Totally the Cliff Rockmore. Like he's very artistic in he's the one who added some of those insane elements to both Human Tornado and this one, where he was just like, knew how to like basically with no money, make it look really cool and really interesting.
There's a scene at one point too that I just wrote this down. So, and I watched this about 3 nights ago, where a guy is so scared he pisses his pants, but he also poops his pants, and they have like a gross, disgusting shot of it and everything.
No.
So this one, I guess, because Dimension Pictures, I said that he lost the rights to the first two films. Dimension Pictures had gone under, so they got a new producer on this one. And then while they're in production, they ran out of money, I guess. And Bert Steiger is the producer on this one, or one of the producers. And so he kind of took over the production and was trying to take the reels. And the cinematographer admits that they held back key shots because a bunch of people hadn't been paid. And they basically held chunks of the film as ransom so that everybody would get paid before they would turn it over, which is crazy. And
not legal.
Yeah, highly illegal. but he admits it. He admits that they did it.
He's like, he's like, and it's not something I would do again.
Yeah. And then the editor on the film had some insane stories. But one of the things was that he was in the editing room in the Dunbar. They had set up an editing bay, I guess. And he was saying that he was editing 24/7. He wasn't leaving, taking little naps in the editing room and then getting back up and working. And he said he would send people out to get him new underwear, so that he wouldn't, because he wasn't showering and he wasn't changing his clothes, which is
TMI, buddy.
Yeah, crazy. But
he's also just like this sweet, like little old, effeminate man, just like telling the story. And I'm like, honey, what would they did they like lock you in there? Like what?
And he's always like, he's talking about everybody so fondly, and he's like, it was crazy, but you know, like it was such a wild time that I have vivid memories of. And he kept referring to the director as Cliffy.
Yeah.
It's like, oh yeah, and Cliffy went and did this for me, and Cliffy went. And it's like,
but just think how fun it would have been on the set of any of those movies.
Oh, I can't even imagine. Yeah. There's I think it's in the Disco Godfather one. One of the cinematographers is saying, I did this years ago, and my memories from this shoot are vivid because it was one of the most insane, strangest, and most like fun experiences I've ever had. And he's like, I've worked on shoots that I worked on last year. I couldn't tell you a single thing about it. But yeah, the editor on Petey Wheat Straw, his name was Jack Tucker, and I looked him up real quick. He was one of the editors on Nightmare on Elm Street 4. But he also worked with Fred Olin Ray on the film Biohazard. And he also worked with Ray Dennis Steckler, the Bloodshack guy, on Sacrilege or Sexorcist.
Wow.
So he's like worked with Ray Dennis Steckler, Fred Olin Ray, and Rudy Ray Moore.
Yep.
Three of the three named like B movie icons.
Yeah. If there was a B movie, like lower B movie, Mount Rushmore, it would be yeah.
Totally.
That's a credit most people can't say they have. That's cool.
Right. And then the other crazy story was that so the Dunbar, I guess, like I was saying, it was like pretty much run down. They were squatting and they're filming mostly in the basement or on the roof in this movie. But the one of the floors up top was haunted and everybody knew that. I guess there was like an old prize fighter who was murdered on that floor, who haunted that floor. And there were multiple sightings of him specifically during the production of P.D. Wheatstraw. And everybody's kind of freaked out by it. But there was a security guard on site that was like kind of like pissed at them most of the time, but had a firearm to protect them and the building from like local gangs and things like that at the time. But they saw the ghost and they were freaked out. And so they were on the roof filming and they sent the guy dressed as Satan down thinking that he could spook the ghost and get him to go away. And instead he spooked the security guard, who fired a shot at his head and just missed him and cut through his giant wig he was wearing.
Yeah.
And blasted a hole straight through his wig, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
geez. Which is,
don't stick up on the guy with the gun, I
yeah,
guess.
Don't stick up on the guy.
Yeah. Yes. I think that's a lesson we all should learn, yeah. Always.
Since you haven't watched Disco Godfather, I don't want to ruin it too much. But Disco Godfather is the final film of Rudy Ray Moore's.
This film will thrill you and fill you with satisfaction because it has a whole lot of action. See the beautiful disco skate dances. See the daring whack attack. This film will leave you simply breathless. This film stars me, Rudy Ray Moore, as the Disco Godfather, along with Carol Speed. So everybody come on out and put your weight on it. Put your weight on it for the Disco Godfather. This film is rated R.
This movie, it was a huge bomb. He was kind of just still trying to make ends meet because of the losing the rights to the first two films. And P.D. Wheatstraw was not as much of a hit. It did pretty well. But because because they had run out of money, they were sort of in it with the producer, and so he didn't have as much money. So they were trying to get Disco Godfather to just kind of give him another boost. So the producers had thought that this was going to be the cleaner, more like wide appeal version of Rudy Ray Moore. Which, if you've seen it, it's fucking insane. Like, it's not clean. It's not. It's not that at all, and I don't know how they ever thought it was.
Well, I think what they're going for was like, I mean, I don't know when these started, but I think they're going for like that after school special kind of vibe.
Definitely were.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a whole drug message in Disco Godfather. The general plot is that he is a ex-cop who is now a disco DJ at a club, and
oh, I thought he was the club owner. Is he not the club owner?
I don't believe, well, he might be, but they're basically making it seem that he's the main attraction.
He's the MC.
And so when he comes out, like they kind of set him up and he comes out and it's, you know, but he might also be the club owner. I didn't catch that, but the city is rampant with angel dust or PCP or whack. They keep calling it as well. They call it by all those names. This kid who's a up and coming basketball star smokes a bunch of PCP, goes out of his mind, freaks out on the disco dance floor. Who's a friend of Rudy Ray Moore's. And then, you know, Rudy Ray gets a tour of the PCP specific hospital where they have all these people.
Yes, the wing of the hospital that is dedicated to PCP recovery.
because when such people that are freaking out, and then it just becomes this anti PCP movie.
Very specifically PCP.
Yeah.
Like only so PCP. Specifically. even though there's a couple times where I'm like, they had to be coked up in order to do that. Like, holy crap.
That's part of my thing. It's like, but the fact that they're making an anti-drug film about PCP, but using a culture that is specifically known for its drug culture being disco. Like, you're taking disco to sell an anti-drug movie? Like, what a weird choice.
Very weird choice.
Did he jump on? Was 78 kind of when disco was starting to decline?
It was 79. Depending on who you're talking to, some of them say that it was because of the disco theme and disco was dead. That's why the movie bombed. Rudy Ray Moore thinks it was just because they were trying to preach to people about anti-drugs, and he thinks that
he's like, we were making like fun movies that you just want to go and like enjoy. You don't really want to be like preached at and scolded.
And it's a lot of that.
I think he's more onto it than
I mean, the disco thing probably didn't help, but like, yeah.
So it's called Disco Godfather, but there's no mafia or anything involved, huh?
A little bit of like, no, wait, maybe I'm mixing the movies up again.
It's no, there. So the bad guy in this one is played by the actor who was the bus driver in Speed.
Yeah. with an amazing wig.
Crazy wig and mustache.
Yeah, I know that. Okay.
Yeah. and he's basically cooking PCP. He has basically a meth lab, but it's like a PCP lab in this building, which the Dunbar. And he's sort of a drug. He's sort of a drug kingpin, but I don't know if he's necessarily the mob at this point. It's just like he's knows Rudy Ray Moore's character. I can't remember what his character's name is.
I wasn't paying 100% attention. Again, I said that earlier, but I could not figure out how the different plot lines connected.
That sounds like a Rudy Ray Moore film to me. That makes sense because Rudy Ray Moore always seemed to be like that. And I think that, to me at least, is the appeal. That they're just live action cartoons that are made for adults by people that have nothing to lose and can do anything and will do anything.
So the director, J. Robert Wagner, it was like he really wanted to do like an epic like art film, but like wrote like this crazy script that was never going to be doable with the budget they had. And so they basically threw that script out. Cliff Rockford came in to write a new script. And because of that, the director was really pissed. And so he still directed the film, but he was more like crowd control is what they kind of referred to it as. And Rockmore was in the background kind of directing sequences and helping kind of make it happen. And this film gets way more horror than anything that we've seen from Rudy Ray Moore. Like by the end, it gets super dark and there's like lots of like shots of people like what they're seeing on PCP. And it's like demon creatures and like all kinds of weird, like there's
it doesn't,
like
doesn't help either that that those shots are all just they didn't have any like set pieces for it. So it was just the demon creature with like black space background and maybe some lit fog.
Yeah.
So it's also just very bleak and isolated and
yeah
creepy and oh my goodness. Wow. Cat just stepped on the keyboard again.
So yeah, but it's definitely really weird and dark and creepy by the end. And they also have like animation sequences where like they're animating onto people's faces and there's like weird stuff happening. It's like it goes like full bonkers. Like mm-hmm. I wish it would have done well because we could have seen what more they would have done creatively beyond this point, but like mm-hmm. this is kind of marks to be the end of the Rudy Ray Moore films, which is sad, but I mean it's also
like I was saying before, Lady Reed's best performance.
Yeah, for sure.
And it would have been really, really fun to see her do something else after that.
The other interesting fun like tidbit is that Jimmy Lynch, his credit at the end of the film is makeup angel of death prosthetics. Like, I love that so much.
Makeup angel of death.
And then they kept trying to like force these sayings over and over again. Like the big anti-drug saying was attack the whack, which they get people chanting multiple times, which is super weird.
But not even, it's like, oh God, it's like really awkward politicians like standing at a podium trying to get like the crowd to chant it. And oh, it's just so bad. And the lady who is in it she was the lady who was in Abby. I can't remember her name.
Yeah, Carol Speed, I think, maybe.
Carol Speed. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. That's right. She's Abby.
Yeah. But she does such a good job of being that awkward politician. It's just so like you just are like, oh no, please stop.
Yeah.
Like,
and then for Rudy Ray Moore, whenever he's doing his disco sets, it's always put your weight on it. He is the big catchphrase he keeps trying to push. Like they were trying to sell this like catchphrase, put your weight on it. Which I don't know what the hell that means, but it is what it is. Lots of extended disco dancing sequences, which is just goes on for a really long time.
Some of it's really impressive, though.
Yeah, for sure.
And the costumes are all great.
Yeah. But so there's a book out that there's a biographer. His name is, look at it real quick, Mark Jason Murray. He hung out with Rudy Ray Moore for like a long period of time, it seems like, and just basically documented as much information and stories as he possibly could and put out this book called it's the Authorized Rudy Ray Moore Biography. Thank you for letting me be myself. I have not read this, but it seems like it would be really, really fascinating because he got some really candid information and stories from Rudy Ray Moore, and he's featured throughout the doc a lot. And he's sort of the one who kind of navigates you through Rudy Ray Moore's story. And he kind of admits that, like, you know, depending on what the day you're talking to Rudy, you might get a completely different story, so that the truth lies somewhere in the middle. Mm-hmm. But he even says that, like, one of my favorite quotes that he says that kind of is that, like, Rudy Ray Moore kind of, like, after the Disco Godfather, really kind of disappeared. He didn't do anything really in the 80s and only found a resurgence due to the booming like hip hop and rap scene. Like Two Live Crew sampled him, and he's like featured in some music videos and things like that, which kind of raised him back up again and brought him back into the zeitgeist. But they consider him the godfather of rap, or because he was like, because of all his rhyming stand up routines and things like that, he influenced a lot of like rappers and hip hop artists and stuff.
And I've never heard the records, but when he was doing it live, he was doing it to music, like a live band behind him playing. Yeah. Like, yeah.
So that's, yeah. I mean, it's a fascinating kind of he's got a very fascinating stamp in the pop culture zeitgeist, and kind of was kind of brought back into it with like the reissues of the films when he got the rights back in the 90s. And then because of the sampling that was happening of his comedy records, he was kind of brought back to the attention of people, which is, I don't know. That was when he was brought to my attention, was in the 90s when all that stuff started getting reissued. But the other quick note was that he only was in two other films in this time period, the kind of heyday of Rudy Ray Moore. One of them is Penitentiary 2, which Vinegar Syndrome also put out, and also stars Ernie Hudson as a villain, which we just watched the other night for the first time. It's a fucking bizarre movie.
He's a really bad guy.
Yeah, Ernie Hudson is evil in that movie.
He's a very good actor.
Really creepy. But it's just like a weird like boxing movie, and Rudy Ray Moore literally has like one sequence where he's on a balcony and is just doing his Rudy Ray Moore shtick. He's in it for like a minute, even though he's like got a pretty big credit on it.
Mr. T is in it a whole lot though.
Yeah, and he's great in it. And then the other one is Monkey Hustle, which he did the same year as The Human Tornado, which he is in it a lot more. He plays Goldie, this other hustler on the street that kind of is a rival of Yaphet Kotto's like Oliver-esque gang. And then they end up having to team up.
Hey, brothers, look what's coming down. They, the head slicks themselves. Yaphet Kotto as Big Daddy Fox. Rudy Ray Moore as Glittering Goldie. In Monkey Hustle. Teaching the young bloods how to step forth into the world of flim flam, scoot and scam, cool as they come.
Show me the way, superstar.
And twice as sharp.
You sure is bad.
Badder than bad. They learn to handcuff the lightning, chain the thunder, walk through the graveyard and put the dead on a wonder.
Yaphet Kotto is amazing in it.
Yeah.
And it looks like he's not hardly trying at all. He just breezes through things effortlessly, selling stuff that I'm like, none of this makes any sense. But like,
it's so dumb.
He just said this, just the worst things I've ever heard anybody say. But I believe this completely character. I bought everything you said. It's amazing.
But there's a quick little thing I found about that movie is that they hired Rudy Ray Moore because of his notoriety at that time, because of the success of the Dolomite film. And they brought him in to read, and they were like, oh my God, this guy is terrible. Like, I don't know what we're going to do. And they're like, let's just throw out all of the stuff, dialogue we wrote for him, and just let him just do his own thing. And that's absolutely what you see in the film. Like, he is totally just like, he is Rudy Ray Moore through and through in every sequence. He comes out in these, I'm guessing Jimmy Lynch probably did his outfits for it, because like, crazy gold, like insane outfits in the movie. But
yeah, there's one point where I'm like, oh my God, I need that jacket, and it pans away, and I was like, holy shit, it's a jumpsuit.
Oh boy. But yeah, lastly, I guess if you haven't seen Rudy Ray Moore and we haven't convinced you at this point, I don't know what else we can say, but these movies are well worth checking out, and I highly recommend picking up the Vinegar Syndrome discs if they're still in print, because the special features on there are fantastic. They include like the soundtracks on each disc, they have the little mini docs, which are all really fascinating. And they also include, as they go on, more and more dubbed versions of the film. So there's a German version of Human Tornado, which is bananas, even more insane than the movie in itself. There's a French and German version, I think, in the Disco Godfather one. So if you like that kind of stuff, they really just put every possible thing they could on these discs. So yeah, lastly, our music segment, we're going to go through this quick. Every one of these movies have pretty amazing soundtracks. He's hired some amazing club musicians that he was kind of knew or worked with, but the most hilarious one is the Disco Godfather one, because they were going hard into the disco scene, and it's only really four tracks on the record. They actually One Way Static actually put it out for Record Store Day a couple years ago. It's still readily available, but I'm just going to play a quick clip of Disco Godfather, which is the title track. Obviously, it's an 11-minute track, so we're just going to give you a little sample of it.
Is a godfather of the disco. Is a man blue. He don't give no slack. We'll boogie all around you. Don't take no shit. It's death on angel dust. It's clean to the bone. Let me tell y'all that he's
anyway.
Death on angel dust.
There's, yeah. So good. Anyway, I feel like I've talked way too much about Rudy Ray Moore, but I just love him so much.
No, you can't talk too much.
No, you really can't. He of all the filmmakers, all the amazing American filmmakers of that level of filmmaking, like I feel like I hear about him the least, which is probably for obvious reasons, but not unlike Herschel Gordon Lewis. I feel like he sets a really specific bar that nobody else can get to, just because of like such a combination of like everything happening at the right time, the right people being around, and him being such a, not, I don't know if Herschel Gordon Lewis is like this, but like he's such a nice guy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. He needs, everybody needs to know how amazing.
I'm really happy that Netflix film got made. I was really excited when I found out that was in production, because I feel like that alone has opened a lot of people's eyes to him as a character, and it's definitely given them a kind of an interest in checking him out. But
and the good news is, if you have Amazon Prime, both the movies are on there right now.
Oh, nice.
And I am sure they're on a couple other platforms too. So if you have that, you can watch it. So go watch it. Yeah. What are you doing?
Do it. Watch it. Watch it. Watch it. Watch it.
All right. Well, thanks for listening. We have another epic episode here, but it was worth it because it's Rudy Ray Moore. If you haven't checked us out already, we have a Video Killers Facebook page, and we have a Tape Freaks blog spot, and then we also have a Tape Freaks Facebook page. So check us out there. Please stick with us and keep listening as we get into more and more bizarre film topics that we are excited to talk about.
Yeah. Our episodes are only going to get longer.
Oh, God.
Yeah, I'm going to stop editing soon, so they're going to get really long.
All right. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
See you on the other side.
On the next episode of Video Killers.
Lightning flashed from above the room, illuminating the attic area. There seemed to be no roof.